It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last week, Politico published a draft opinion that was leaked from the U.S. Supreme Court. This opinion suggested that the highest court in the land could be poised to overturn the landmark Roe v. Wade. The news reverberated throughout the country with those who support and oppose abortion rights, but the leak shocked the many former clerks who worked under the justices. Amy Wildermuth is the dean of the University of Pittsburgh Law School and clerked for then-Justice John Paul Stevens. Amy, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
Amy, briefly, tell us, what are the duties of a clerk?
Your responsibilities as a clerk are whatever your justice tells you to do. So those are largely reading through cert petitions. So a vast majority of your job is reading the petitions that come in for cases that people want heard at the Supreme Court. You also weigh in various ways on the merits cases, which are the cases that are being argued. And then there's some emergency work that you do, meaning the stays and what some folks have now called the shadow docket.
Mm-hmm. When Chief Justice Roberts confirmed that the leaked draft was authentic, he also said it didn't represent a final decision. How common is it for drafts of potential rulings to be floated around and maybe adjusted?
So that's the practice at every court that I've ever worked in. So when you have a case heard at the Supreme Court or at a court of appeals, it is very typical for the justice or judge who's assigned the majority opinion to send around drafts. And at the Supreme Court in particular, it's a very traditional and formal process. It goes around to each of the justices, and then they have time to comment on that draft, provide suggestions, provide edits.
Mm-hmm. Now, the difference between a draft and a final decision, whether it's two versions, three versions, whatever it is, usually is it just a tweaking of a phrase or two, or the scope, the parameters of the potential ruling?
It can be substantial and it can be minor. It really varies by the case, and it should come as no surprise that some of the bigger cases, meaning cases in which things are going to change more than stay the same, you likely will see more drafts and more edits. In this particular instance, it would not be uncommon for there to be many different drafts floated, many different ideas about how to proceed.
In your time as a clerk, do you know of any final ruling that was a major change from early drafts?
Absolutely. Of course, I can't tell you any of those cases because that's part of my obligation to the Supreme Court. But outside of the year I was there, there have been many cases now that folks know maybe came out after a conference, which is where they talk about how they should come out in an opinion. It may come out differently than they had thought originally. And there's lots of instances where that has happened. Those are times where maybe a justice changes their mind and decides after reading the majority opinion, they want to do something different.
Mm-hmm. When you heard about the leak, what was your reaction? Not so much as to the content of Justice Alito's writing, but rather that this was leaked.
I was heartbroken. The court, you know, has integrity only because it has been a very careful place. And it has been so careful that you very rarely have a leak of this sort. Mm-hmm. It was devastating to that integrity.
We are used to leaks from the other two branches of government, White House, Congress, sometimes intentionally by the people who want it to be leaked, but others who get a hold of the information, but not the judiciary.
That's always been the sort of crowning achievement of the judiciary, that we keep our secrets, that we hold them tight, and that we protect the work that's being done so that it can be done at the very highest level. In my view, that protection has been the thing that has made the court what it is, that a reliable institution that has integrity.
Chief Justice Roberts says he's ordered an investigation. How do you believe this could affect the high court and the public's perception of it? You have used the word integrity.
So I think this is a really important moment for the court to consider what it's going to do. I have an idea. Some have floated other ideas. But I will say, just as a purely procedural matter, because the court's docket is discretionary, they ought to say they are not going to issue an opinion in this case. They can do something called dig it, which is dismiss it as improvidently granted, or they could hold it and argue one of the other cases, or they could re-argue it in the next term. But they ought not to issue an opinion in this case.
Mm-hmm. So what good would that do if they re-argue this case? Because the makeup, you know, conservative versus liberal, it's going to stay the same, really.
That's true. But here's the difference. When you have something of this sort happen with a case, you have to say, we are going to do what due process requires of us, which is to rehear it. Now, it may not ultimately change the outcome. However, I think the process of rehearing it, perhaps hearing a different case and holding this case for that case, I think that makes a difference in the eye of the public, that we aren't going to rush to judgment. And when we have a flaw of this sort, we take care of it. We remedy it. We take care of the stench that's created by a leak of this sort.
And briefly, is there a fix to it? Not just this particular case, this particular incident, but a leak?
We'll have to see exactly what the cause of the leak was. My guess is that it is more likely to be something inadvertent than something intentional.
Amy Wohlermuth is the Dean of Pitts Law School. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A report published last month finds that teachers of color are underrepresented in Pennsylvania schools. The issue is acute in Allegheny County. Earlier research by Philadelphia nonprofit Research for Action found Pittsburgh is experiencing a steady loss of black teachers. Here to discuss the findings, David Lapp, Director of Policy Research for Research for Action. Welcome, David.
Good to be with you.
And also with us in studio is Gretchen Jenneret, Dean of Duquesne University School of Education. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
David, how wide is the disparity between students of color in public schools and their teachers?
Well, across Pennsylvania, we have around 36.5% students of color, but we only have 6.2% teachers of color. So this is one of the largest disparities in the country. Of course, this is a problem nationally. We see this gap nationally, but the scope of the gap, the scope of the disparity between students and teachers in Pennsylvania is among the largest in the country.
And the gap is even wider for Hispanic students?
Hispanic students and teachers have one of the largest disproportionalities in the Commonwealth. There are about 13.1% Hispanic students, but only 1.2% of our teachers are considered Hispanic.
To both of you, why does it matter? Why does race or ethnicity of teachers matter? What impact does that have on students? Gretchen, let's start with you.
Well, you know, I think as someone who's been in education for over 20 years now, as a black woman standing in front of students year after year, I ask the question, how many of you have had teachers of color in your experience? And these are young people preparing to go into classrooms K through 12. And for many of them, having a college professor is the first time that they've had a teacher of color. And so when you ask me why is it important, I think when we look to the vast diversity in this country and we look to the many things that young people are being called to do, the earlier we have experiences with people who are different from us, the better we are able to work with and get along with folks. And so being able to be with people who are different from you and work with people who are different from you is not just the moral thing and ethical thing to do, in my opinion. It's also good business sense and good community sense.
David?
Agree 100%. And the research backs all of that up. We know that when students of color have teachers of color, we see higher expectations, we see better student outcomes, reduced absenteeism, increased outcomes for students, improved school climate. But beyond that, it's almost also kind of an obvious question or answer, right? We would not ask that question if there was a disparity for white students and white students didn't have white teachers. We would understand that of course is important, representation matters. The research and sort of common sense supports the importance of this. Mm-hmm.
And of course, the numbers we are talking about are for public schools. David, one specific finding from your report are fewer black teachers in Philadelphia public schools than 20 years ago. An early report showed in 2001 in Pittsburgh public schools, 18% of teachers were black. And in 2019, that had fallen to 11.6%. David, are teachers of color just moving within the state or what?
The overall state average has barely budged over the last 8 years or so. We've just slightly increased our overall numbers of teachers of color. But in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, as you said, there's been significant decline over the last 20 years to the point where today there are fewer teachers of color of all race ethnicities than there were of black teachers just 20 years ago. Some of them are leaving clearly the Philadelphia and Pittsburgh area and going into local suburban communities, but that doesn't explain the overall extent of the loss of black teachers in those regions.
Mm-hmm. Gretchen, approximately how many students in the School of Education are people of color? What's your enrollment overall?
Right. So if we're looking at just undergraduate students, we have just under 400 students who are undergraduate students. And it is sad to say that we can count on both hands how many of those students are students of color. And that would be our pre-service teachers, young people looking to go into the classroom who are between the ages of 18 and 22.
As a dean, as an educator, as a person of color, does that discourage you?
Absolutely. I would also say, Kevin and David knows this, that this is not new information to us. For many, many years, people have been touting the impact of historical and institutional racism on education. And we can look back to losing nearly 40,000 educators of color, specifically black educators, when segregation ended and integration was supposedly happened. It wasn't so much as integration as it was as closing black schools. And so what we know is that if you don't see yourself in roles, it's hard to imagine yourself in those roles. And so we lost generations of black teachers when we closed black schools in the South. We also know that relationships matter in education, and so does the feeling of belonging. And so when students go through schools and they don't see themselves or they don't have very close relationships with teachers that are nurturing, or they don't feel as if they belong, then they don't want to stay in school as a profession, right? They want to move outside of school as quickly as possible and go into other areas or fields. So you have the unfortunate circumstance of black students and other students of color just not imagining themselves as teachers and educators.
Do you actively recruit students of color to be future teachers?
Absolutely. And
what do you tell them?
We tell them that it's a great profession. We tell them that it's a wonderful way to have an impact on the next generation. We talk about the amount of influence they can have on young people. But I go back to some of the research that comes out of David's organizations' reports and other reports, that what is so hard for black teachers and other teachers of color to deal with is the structural racism that they experience, the daily macroaggressions that they feel. And so we see even those who come into the field and who teach for a while, many of them will leave because of those bad experiences.
David, in your report, your organization talks about a, quote, leaky pipe of teacher diversity. Tell us a bit about where future teachers are leaving the system, and can we patch those leaks?
So in Pennsylvania, inequity is sort of the distinguishing characteristic of our public education system. We have one of the most inequitable school funding systems. We see the most inequitable opportunities for learning for students, and we see some of the most inequitable outcomes for students. So we see that again all along the teaching pipeline. We're losing potential students of color from high school graduation. We're losing them in matriculation into college and enrollment in teacher prep programs. We're losing them in the numbers who are taking praxis and passing and receiving certification. And we see it in the numbers who are being hired. And then, of course, the big, big issue that we don't talk about enough is retention. We are putting our teachers of color oftentimes in many of the hardest teaching positions and asking them, demanding the most from them in those positions. And so it's not surprising that they're leaving, their attrition rates are higher than for white teachers. And so to fix this, of course, requires a comprehensive approach to working all along the pipeline, all throughout recruitment, but then also really focusing on retention and making sure we have schools that are places that teachers want to stay and make a career.
Mm-hmm. Are there ways that possibly the state could help address these issues, Gretchen?
Well, I think it's really important that the state thinks about what it means to not have an educated population that's going to stay in the state and contribute to its well-being. I think we need to incentivize teaching. We know that we cannot have lots of different industries, whether you're going into the trades, whether you're going on to college, that good, fundamental, foundational, basic K through 12 education is paramount to us being able to meet those goals. And so I think our legislators need to highly consider what it means when we don't have enough educators in the classroom to produce good outcomes with students.
Mm-hmm. Briefly, David, can the state help?
The state can absolutely help. There was an initiative last 2 years ago that they launched called Aspiring to Educate, which was a pilot program looking to recruit additional students to enter into the teaching profession. It's a start. It's not enough. There are a lot more with regard to funding, incentives, and loan forgiveness and supports that students need throughout the way. There are, as Gretchen mentioned earlier, there are people who've been working on this for a long time. I'll just call out the Center for Black Educator Development, which has been doing some really terrific work on this issue, and the state can replicate that work.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. David Lapp is the Director of Policy Research for Research for Action. David, thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much.
And Gretchen Jenrette is Dean of Duquesne University School of Education. Thanks for being here, Gretchen.
My pleasure.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. In Allegheny County, there are wide disparities between libraries in the wealthiest communities and the poorest. In a joint reporting project with Public Source, 90.5 WESA's Kate Chiamarisi says the current funding system fails to even the playing field, though some are pushing for more equity.
The historic Braddock Carnegie Library is closed for renovations, so the library is located temporarily in a small storefront in this Mon Valley community. Against the wall, there's a row of computers for patrons to use. Shelves of books and DVDs are crammed together nearby. The front window is covered with flyers advertising library programs and social services. The library serves high-poverty communities including North Braddock, East Pittsburgh, and Turtle Creek. Often, residents come here to use a computer or a copier.
Are the birth certificates
and two copies of that? Two copies of this.
On a recent Monday, the librarian is assisting Braddock resident Jennifer Baxter, who needs copies of documents for a housing application.
I think having a library in every community is essential. You know, you can get web access, any books, any information you need, copies. You know, like you can pretty much get anything you need at a library.
Braddock is just one of 46 separate library systems in Allegheny County. Those different libraries have wide disparities in their staffing, finances, and the kinds of programming they can offer. Carol Shreve runs the Carnegie of Homestead, which also serves a high-poverty community. She says many libraries outside of the city of Pittsburgh have high staff turnover.
So we want to be able to have quality staff who can make an honest living. We don't want people to go home and worry about food insecurities. We want to make sure that our staff has a livable wage, and we want to make sure that we can sustain that long term.
So why do some local libraries struggle? Let's look at how funding works. Libraries rely heavily on the Allegheny Regional Asset District, or RAD, which distributes money from a 1% countywide sales tax. WESA's parent organization also receives some RAD funding. Millions of dollars are distributed annually through a formula, but parts of the formula benefit wealthier areas. For example, when a local government allocates money to its library, that library will get more money from RAD. Some communities like Braddock can't afford to do that. Poor communities do get some additional funding, but they're still at a disadvantage. On a per capita basis, Braddock's library will get less in RAD money this year than libraries in Upper St. Clair and Mount Lebanon. Not only are there 45 suburban libraries all trying to get a piece of the pie, the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh gets the lion's share of the RAD funds. To address funding concerns, there's been a push from RAD for more libraries to share services, like accounting and payroll. Here's Dan Griffin, a longtime RAD board member.
We've been really nudging, pushing, cajoling, and threatening.
He's been part of discussions between RAD and all libraries in Allegheny County.
I said, we'd like to do this with you. We don't want to do it for you, but if we don't get some level of cooperation that we think is better than what we've been getting, we will do it to you.
Since those discussions, there has been some collaboration, and libraries have worked to push more money to places like Braddock. One obvious financial solution that isn't really being talked about is merging systems. Most in the Allegheny County library world see that as unlikely. Rachel Brem is the library director in Braddock.
If we were going to redo it, we would not do it this way. I don't think anyone would choose this, but I don't see a whole bunch of mergers in the future.
But with flat state funding and increasing budgetary pressures, other solutions will be needed soon. Kate Jamarisi, 90.5 WESA News.
This story was co-reported with Rich Lord of Public Source. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, Pittsburgh is not seeing the rebound from the drops in employment over the last 2 years. And 1 week ahead of the primary, we talk with the Allegheny County Elections Manager. Thanks to our team, Laura Satsui and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.